content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Ed Tremblay from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the Tar Heel Junior Historian Magazine, North Carolina History for Students. Today I'm reading from Volume 62, Number 2, the Spring 2023 issue, Legacies of Reconstruction, North Carolina After Emancipation. And we're going to start with Fannie Whitney and Black Women's Battle for Survivors' Benefits in Post-Civil War America. This is written by Brandy C. Brimmer, who is the Moorhead Kane Alumni Associate Professor in the Department of African American, and Diaspora Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and the author of Claiming Union Widowhood, Race, Respectability, and Poverty in the Post-Emancipation South, published by Duke University Press in 2020. After the American Civil War, newly freed black women made up one of the largest groups of Union widows across the South. Yet their struggle for recognition by the Federal Bureau of Pensions remains an understudied dimension of the war and its aftermath. Their petitions for survivor benefits, and the first-person testimony of those who supported them, paint a vivid picture of their survival strategies in free labor society. In claiming the pensions, which is money paid on a quarterly basis to disabled Union soldiers or families of soldiers killed in battle or because of a war-related illness or injury during the Civil War, in claiming the pensions to which they were in principle entitled, these women challenged the Bureau's definition of Union widowhood and expanded the boundaries of United States citizenship. The Bureau of Pensions distributed monetary resources to widows, children, and other dependent relatives of Union soldiers through a legal structure that required proof of marriage and evidence of war-related death. Enslaved people had not been allowed to legalize their marriages, so it was impossible for formerly enslaved women to secure pension benefits. President Abraham Lincoln acknowledged this legal barrier in a letter to Senator Charles Sumner on May 19, 1864. Lincoln recommended that the wives of black soldiers receive the same as if their marriages were legal, so that they can have the benefit of the provisions made the widows and orphans of white soldiers. Federal lawmakers eventually addressed this problem through the Supplementary Pension Act of July 4, 1864, and two additional acts introduced in June 1866. Still, a tedious and complicated application, limited economic resources, and competing definitions of what constituted a legal marriage made securing a pension difficult. Maintaining their standing on the pension roster could be just as intense. Freed woman Fannie Whitney was one of many black women in eastern North Carolina who asserted their views of citizenship and worthiness to the Bureau of Pensions. Born in Craven County, Fannie successfully petitioned for survivors' benefits based on her husband Harry Whitney's military service around 1867. Harry Whitney was one of 5,035 recruits to enlist in the black regiments raised in North Carolina. He enlisted at Roanoke Island, located off the coast of North Carolina, where the families of some black soldiers lived during the war. Living conditions for freedom seekers at Roanoke proved challenging, as the colony offered a modest means of work in the form of agricultural labor and gardening for the inhabitants, most of them women, children, and disabled or elderly men. Fannie's story of survival on Roanoke Island, migration to New Bern after Harry's death, and post-war engagement with the federal pension system is recorded in her pension file housed at the National Archives in Washington, D.C. Grieving the loss of her husband and adjusting to the demands of raising her surviving children proved difficult. Fannie leaned on family and kin for support as she transitioned her family to New Bern, a port city and center of black political activity. As of 1870, the federal census shows that Fannie and her children, occupied a small house among a group of newly emancipated black people. She prioritized education and work, as at least one of her boys enrolled in classes. Though her occupation is listed as keeping house, other records indicate that Fanny worked as a laundress, a woman who works washing and ironing clothes. The laundress profession allowed women like Fanny to return home at the end of the workday. That meant that the line dividing the personal and professional was more clearly defined than when other occupations in the domestic service sector during the late 1800s and early 1900s. At the end of the war, freed women like Fanny Whitney set about filing petitions for survivors' benefits with great frequency. Fanny and thousands of black women across the South rested their claims on their contributions to slavery's demise and their loved ones' military service. Though not always successful, their struggle for recognition as Union widows by the federal government underscores black women's legal insight and understanding of the Bureau of Pensions as an arena of activism and redress. Here are the captions accompanying the photographs of this article. Sylvia Connor, seamstress and businesswoman, New Bern, 1863. There are no known images of Fanny Whitney, whose story is shared in this article, but these two black women lived in New Bern at the same time. Their photos help show what life was like for free black women during these times. The other photograph, tintype of Mary Jane Connor, cook and boarding house keeper, New Bern, 1863. And there's also an image courtesy of the Wilson Library, University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, with the caption, "A James City Doorway, New Bern, Unidentified African American Children, Late 1800s. Next article, The Kirk Holden War of 1870. This is written by Jim D. Brisson, who is a history and sociology instructor at Robeson Community College. He wrote his thesis on the Kirk Holden War while in graduate school at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. In the summer of 1870, another war broke out in Alamance and Caswell counties in North Carolina. This war, unlike the Civil War that had ended just 5 years earlier, was not fought on battlefields. The Kirk Holden War was a political showdown between Republican Governor William Woods Holden and the Ku Klux Klan, or KKK. Governor Holden sought to guide North Carolina through Reconstruction and protect freedmen from Klan violence, which had started in 1868 and intensified throughout 1869 and 1870. On February 26, 1870, the Klan increased its political violence by kidnapping and killing Graham Town Council member Wyatt Outlaw, one of the most prominent African-American leaders in Alamance County. Then on May 21, 1870, the KKK assassinated Republican State Senator John W. Stevens in the Caswell County Courthouse. After these assassinations, Governor Holden declared Alamance and Caswell counties to be in a state of insurrection. He sent in militia under the command of Colonel George Washington Kirk, a former Union Army officer from Tennessee, to restore order and arrest suspected Klansmen. The Klan intimidated witnesses. One investigator reported that when they come before me, they speak of it, knowledge of the Klan, with bated breath, as though they were afraid somebody were behind the door. Kirk's men arrested more than 100 suspected Klansmen, including the sheriffs of both counties. Holden's militia campaign succeeded in its immediate goal, as all Klan violence in Caswell and Alamance counties ceased. His decision to send in the militia, however, would have more far-reaching consequences for both the North Carolina Republican Party and the fate of Reconstruction in the state. In the aftermath of Holden's militia campaign, the conservative Democratic press created the term Kirk Holden War to describe the events in a deliberate attempt to discredit the governor's actions. Newspapers like the Raleigh Sentinel and the Wilmington Journal lambasted Holden's war, yet failed to report on the Klan violence that had caused it. The Raleigh Sentinel, for example, labeled Holden a demagogue, trickster, and political desperado. The press campaign against Holden whipped up such a furor that the conservative Democratic Party won control of the state legislature in the election of 1870. The conservative-controlled General Assembly then started impeachment proceedings against Holden. Holden's trial lasted from January 30th to March 22nd, 1871. Since his political enemies controlled the Senate, Holden believed that the verdict was a foregone conclusion, and he was not even present to hear the verdict read. The state Senate convicted Holden on 6 counts and voted to immediately remove him from office. Holden became the first governor in American history to be impeached and removed from office. In 2011, the North Carolina Senate posthumously, after the person's death, pardoned Governor Holden. Today we correct a 140-year-old wrong, said State Senator Neil Hunt, the Republican who initiated the resolution, before a 48-0 vote. Senator Floyd B. McKissick, Jr., an African-American Democrat from Durham, said the conviction was repugnant in every respect, and justice demands that it be reversed. Holden's removal was basically the end of the Republican Party in North Carolina for the remainder of the 1800s and well into the 1900s. Republicans never regained control of the General Assembly during Reconstruction, and only one Republican governor was elected in the century between Holden's removal in 1871 and 1972. With the virtual collapse of the Republican Party in North Carolina, this too meant that Reconstruction was derailed, and that the state was firmly on the road to redemption. Redemption in the South was the repudiation or rejection of Reconstruction. Redeemers believed that the Republican Party in the South should be curtailed. They also sought to dismantle newly gained rights for African Americans. Achieving these goals would ensure that white Southern Democrats would return to power throughout the South. Here are the captions accompanying the photographs that are in this article. It's a picture of George Washington Kirk, circa 1870, an engraving of John W. Stevens, who was assassinated by the Ku Klux Klan in the Caswell County Courthouse on May 21, 1870, an engraving of Governor William Woods Holden, published in 1906. The Caswell County Courthouse, 2009. This building, built between 1858 and 1861, was the site of John W. Stevens's murder. The Ku Klux Klan, KKK, is a secret terrorist organization that was founded during Reconstruction to suppress the rights of newly freed African Americans. Klan members frequently wore disguises such as this to hide their identity. They intimidated black freedmen and harassed white Republicans with lynchings, beatings, and destruction of property. The next article is Rebuilding Education by Sally Causey Bloom, who relishes diving into the past as it continually informs the present and future. She is an educator at the North Carolina Museum of History. Remember your first backpack? Starting school, whether it is a public, charter, independent, tribal, or homeschool, is something that all North Carolina children know about today. But years ago, most children in the state did not expect to attend school. In North Carolina, the Common Schools Law of 1839 began the state public school system for white children. This meant that some poorer white children had their first opportunity for education. Between 1840 and 1850, thousands of schools opened across the state. School teachers worked for 2 to 9 month-long sessions, and children of all ages were taught together. American Indian children were not allowed to attend these schools, and it remained illegal to teach enslaved children and free children of color to read and write. Some of these children learned, despite their restrictions, on their own, from others in their community who were literate, or from white people like Quakers who disagreed with the law. War means change. The Civil War, from 1861 to 1865, brought changes to the state's schools. Funding went to war efforts, and students and teachers were needed at home or in the army. For others, the war offered opportunities for learning. Where Union troops controlled parts of eastern North Carolina, schools were opened for freedom seekers who fled to the area. Following the war's end, black people and American Indians of all ages knew that education was essential to their futures, and they sought to learn wherever, whenever, and from whoever possible. Private funders and charitable groups established schools that met at night, on Sundays, and whenever people could meet. The Freedmen's Bureau built schools as well, day schools, night schools, and industrial schools. What was the Freedmen's Bureau? Just before the war ended, Congress established the Bureau of Refugees, Freedmen, and Abandoned Lands, known as the Freedmen's Bureau. The Bureau had many responsibilities, including helping formerly enslaved people. The Bureau worked with benevolent societies or charities to build and staff schools for newly freed people. Schools in Wilmington, Fayetteville, Bladenboro, Goldsboro, and Brunswick County were established by Rhode Island's Samuel Ashley, who came to North Carolina in September 1865 on behalf of the American Missionary Association and the Freedmen's Bureau. The 10 schools that Ashley established educated some 1,800 students. New Constitution, New Public School Provision. The state's 1868 Constitution called for a free public school program system for all children ages 6 to 21, which would be paid for with tax monies. And to help coordinate schooling, the Constitution provided for a superintendent of public instruction. Samuel Ashley was elected superintendent of public instruction once the 1868 Constitution was enacted. He worked to revive the public school system for white students that had collapsed during the war, expanding it to include both white and black children. He faced many challenges, including a lack of funding, few school buildings, fewer teachers, and almost no books. His task was made more difficult because many white people did not want integrated schools, and many were hostile to any education for black students. Some also resented teachers who came from northern states to work in southern schools. Have schools, need teachers. As more children attended school, it was clear that more teachers were needed. A school to train teachers was called a normal school, and during that time, some 13 normal schools across the state helped prepare teachers for the classroom, 8 for black educators and 5 for white. Ashley chose to create 2 school systems, one for black students and one for white children. He recruited the Reverend James Walker Hood as assistant superintendent to manage the black school system. Hood, a missionary, came in 1864 to the Union-occupied area of North Carolina, where he founded many African Methodist Episcopal Zion churches. A leader of the 1865 Freedmen's Convention, and a participant at the state's 1868 Constitutional Convention, Hood was successful in creating educational opportunities for some 49,000 black students by 1871. Were there schools for African Americans? Yes. The school systems established by the 1868 Constitution provided for a general and uniform system of public schools, wherein tuition shall be free of charge to all children of the state between the ages of 6 and 21 years. Most likely, the intent of white leaders was for Native children to attend schools established for black people. Many American Indian parents, wanting Indian schools for their children, worked within their communities to establish schools for tribal children in the mid to late 1800s. In 1859, the Kohari started a subscription school for tribal children. The tribe provided funding and teachers. In 1878, in High Plains in Person County, the Saponi formed a school. In the mid-1800s, Jeremiah Methodist Church, a religious and education center, was established by the Halliwa Saponi. 1885, the people known as Lumbee started a teacher's school that also taught younger students. Today, this school is the University of North Carolina at Pembroke. And in 1885, the Waccamaw Siouan established the Doe Head School. The Cherokee established schools in the 1820s. In the 1830s, however, when many Cherokee were forcibly removed from the region, most of those schools closed. Some tribal children in North Carolina and many across the country were forced to attend boarding schools as a policy of the United States government. The instruction in these schools worked to destroy what it meant to be American Indian. Native language use was not allowed. Cultural practices were generally forbidden, and harsh punishments were inflicted on many children. In North Carolina, four such official schools existed. 1820, Valley Towns Baptist Mission School in Cherokee County. This school gained many students when the written Cherokee language came into use in lessons. Cherokee leaders who resisted the removal policies of the 1830s were educated here. 1881, Cherokee Boarding School in Cherokee. This school was run by the Quakers, the Society of Friends, then by the United States Indian Service until 1954. Circa 1882, Judson College in Henderson County, a training school for girls, and in 1882, Trinity College Industrial Boarding School in Randolph County, where 20 Cherokee attended until 1887. What about colleges and universities? They were built. Of course, the University of North Carolina was founded in 1789. Even after the Civil War, for decades, only white men could attend. But in Raleigh, on December 1, 1865, a freedman's theology class led to the founding of Shaw University, the South's first black college, just 8 months following the end of the Civil War. And in 1882, Leonard Medical School, which offered the nation's first four-year medical program, opened at Shaw. Other centers of learning specifically for African Americans were founded in the years following the end of the Civil War, especially as segregation gained ground across the South. Known as Historically Black Colleges and Universities, HBCUs, these institutions offered opportunities to many and continue to do so today. In North Carolina, HBCUs, listed by their founding dates, contemporary names, and current locations, afforded access to education for black people. 1865, Shaw University in Raleigh. 1867, Fayetteville State University in Fayetteville, Johnson C. Smith University in Charlotte, Barber Scotia College in Concord, and St. Augustine's University in Raleigh. 1873, Bennett College in Greensboro. 1879, Livingstone College in Salisbury. 1886, closed in 1975, Kittrell College in Kittrell. In 1891, the North Carolina Agricultural and Technical State University at Greensboro and Elizabeth City State University in Elizabeth City. In 1892, Winston-Salem State University in Winston-Salem, and in 1910, North Carolina Central University in Durham. Dozens of schools of higher learning for white men and women opened during these years, as did two additional state colleges, North Carolina State College of Agriculture and Engineering in 1887, now North Carolina State University, and the North Carolina College for Women in 1891, now the University of North Carolina, Greensboro. Everyone was learning. Yes, but. Rebuilding the state's economic, political, civic, and social infrastructure required educated people. By 1900, all North Carolina counties had graded school systems. Not all school systems were the same, however. Because schools received money mostly from local taxes, most rural schools did without, as the income from those areas was lower. And, like many Reconstruction efforts, racial prejudice affected education efforts as separate but equal schools were built and funded for black and white students. They were separate but definitely not equal. The desire to learn remained strong across the state's communities, no matter the challenges. There's a sidebar article, were all children required to go to school? No. For years, children helped on family farms. With the rise of textile mills and other industries, however, many children began working long hours every day. In 1900, the textile mills in North Carolina had more child laborers than any other state, and most of them were unable to read or write. In 1913, a new statewide law required children to attend school. This meant that children ages 8 to 12 were to attend school for 4 months a year. Broad regulation of child labor laws would be decades in the making. There's a photograph with this article, sidebar. This young girl looks so tired. How many hours had she been working in the spinning room by the time this photo was taken? Lewis Hines traveled throughout the South to photograph children working like this to document the use of child labor in textile mills. And here are the captions for the photographs accompanying the main article. This group photo of students at the Cherryville graded school included every grade up through high school. It's picture day. These American Indian children of the tribe now known as the Lumbee knew not to misbehave while the photograph was being taken. The school principal, Mr. H. L. Eden, sat nearby. In 1885, the Lumbee started a school, and in 1911, North Carolina's government recognized the school as a state institution. This school eventually became the University of North Carolina at Pembroke. Does your school have several grade levels? The students who attended this school in the North Carolina mountains were in different grades, but all learned together in one room. One-room schools were common for many years. This image is from around 1900 to 1915. And do you wear hats to school? Some students attending Professor Jacobs School for Black Children in Columbus County did. It's a photograph of Professor Jacobs School, an early school for black children. Students and teachers pose for a class picture. Lake Waccamaw, Columbus County, early 1900s. Next, stories from our collection. A writing slate, circa 1865 to 1875. Do you sometimes complain about having to do homework? Imagine if you were not even allowed to learn. During slavery, laws banned enslaved people from learning to read and write. After emancipation, African Americans celebrated their right to an education. Sally Arrington used this slate in 1866 when she attended first grade at a school set up by the Freedmen's Bureau in the Cary area. Sally's parents helped establish the All-Black Methodist Church in Cary during the 1800s. Sally later married Alfred Arrington, another formerly enslaved person, and they became a prominent family in the area. And a ceremonial sword circa 1893 to 1935. During the Reconstruction era, formerly enslaved men, women, and children became legal citizens, and black men achieved the right to vote. The rights from slavery included electing four African American men to North Carolina, from North Carolina to the United States Congress, including George Henry White from Bladen County. White was elected in 1896 and served 1897 to 1901. He was the last African American to serve in Congress from the Reconstruction era. He was also the last elected congressperson of color from North Carolina until the election of Congresswoman Eva Clayton in 1992. There's a photograph where in 2019, White's sword was presented to the North Carolina Museum of History by businessman and educator Stedman Graham and Vincent Spaulding, director of the George W. White Memorial and Education Center in Bladen County. We've run out of time for today's episode. Be sure to listen next time. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Ed Tremblay, reading from the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.